think we will all be pleased that one of our more infrequent guests, Sid Vincent, who has known our speaker for many, many more years than that, has offered to introduce the speaker. Sid?
I hardly know how to respond to that. I'm comforted with the fact that you said he's going to talk for 2 hours. That means I have about 45 minutes for the introduction, but I have the signals right. Actually, I've been brooding about how it happens. I've been sitting here minding my own business, came here to hear Pete speak, and suddenly I hear I've offered to introduce him. Graciously offered, you left out. I'm wondering, is it part of the season in our religious tradition at this time? We're talking in terms of sin and punishment. And I'm wondering what sin I've committed. I presume it must be the sin of being an infrequent visitor to the Friday lunch.
No, Jimmer.
Quite true. At any rate, I think the real reason is the one that Hal mentioned. I hope this is a proper boast. I presume somebody here is going to tell me it's an improper boast. I think, Pete, I may have met you earlier than anybody around this table. At least I can pinpoint when it happened. If I dare say this, it's exactly 45 years ago, almost to the minute, where as a young pup at Adelbert College, this new young professor, William Powell Jones, came to the heathen to bring us some of the fruits of literature and poetry. And I shall never forget, although I'm sure you have, obscene remark shouted out afterwards, who wandered up the building we used to meet in those days. Hey, Professor, your books are leaking. That was the height of college humor of the day. And I must say, from that time on, 2 years that I spent until I graduated that time, and all the years since, it's been a joy to acknowledge throughout those years the deep debt that all of us who studied with Pete had to him for bringing us so much. It was, one can say this in this unsentimental setting, it was beautiful about the American tradition, for that matter, the Japanese tradition. Now, a chairman, as I understand it, an introducer is supposed to do two things. One, he's supposed to make the speaker comfortable, and I've tried to make Pete very uncomfortable. And the second thing he's supposed to do is to say something about the subject matter, and I know a damn thing about that. So I can only tell you that I'm really delighted all these years later to pay my respects to and to introduce Pete Jones.
This is in the year of 1921. I went out to Japan. Can you hear me down there at the end of the table? I went to the place where I was supposed to be, which was in Himeji. Where is Himeji, they say? Himeji is a place not far from Kobe, which everybody knows about. And it has a noted mainly among the Japanese for its castle. So I'll introduce you to the castle first. The castle's cape spread from my window. I looked on it every day. Spread its great wings over the town. Around it were moats, great playing fields, where boys gathered to play baseball and tennis. Leading to the castle was a great avenue of Japanese cherry trees, sakura. Beyond the castle were factories, and beyond that the hills, where bamboo groves led to a shrine. On the other side of the house was the river Ichikawa, which usually ran quietly, except in the rainy season around July, when it became turbulent and swept down into the inland sea about 5 or 6 miles away. My work in teaching English at the commercial middle school in Himeji, 2 days a week, was supplemented by 2 days a week at a country school 15 miles by the crow flies away. It was about 30 miles the way I had to go at Ono. I was accompanied to classes by a Japanese teacher of English who on occasion would interpret for me. Each of the 5 classes I met for an hour a week with no textbook except for one sheet printed on both sides containing a message in English with much explanation in Japanese. When we went to the classroom, the 40 or 50 boys rose and bowed to me. I bowed in return, and the class began. You asked me when my first experience in teaching? That was it. Their teachers had had them for 4 hours a week, and I had them for only one. So naturally, they didn't learn much from me. It was easy enough to get to the commercial school in the city, especially after I bought a bicycle. But to get to Ono was another matter. I took a train to the next town, Kakagawa, about 15 miles away, where I transferred to another train for the last part of the trip. In good weather, it was a bicycle trip of some 20 miles across country, which I had to learn. I went out to the east, across the river, passing farmers who had accumulated a load of manure, human manure, that is, which I had, human manure from the town. I went to Ono on Tuesday and Wednesday at the commercial school on Thursday and Friday. Days when I transferred at Kakagawa, it seemed ages until I got to Ono. Some days there was no heat at all in the cars. The puffing little engine strode up the hills, pulling two train loads of freight cars beside the regular passenger car. On the train, I read and watched the people. A mother with a crying baby clucks to him. A brown old lady going to the train, pulls her bundle over her shoulder, and then ties the straps in front. A wizened old man with a stubbly beard and towel around his neck sits in a vacant mood, smokes a cigarette or his little long-stemmed pipe, using the same tobacco for both. As I cycled over the hills, I watched a pair of farmers at work, a plow pulled by a bullock and guided by a farmer with one hand as it turned to sweep up the soil in the small rice paddies, the water being led into the field, and three women in dresses tucked up, working in the field with the tender young rice plants, setting them down in perfect rows. For several months, I could watch the plants grow and reach maturity, and then came the harvest, the rice being cut off, sickled, and carefully tied up into small bundles to be stripped of their grain by pulling the straw through a device with teeth. Twice a year, they grew the rice in the little quadrilateral fields, all buried it with wheat. Between the winnowings, the farmer folk gathered around the little side porches of their crude houses, a baby tied on their backs, peeping out of the bundle of clothes meant to be washed, meant to keep it there warm. I passed a dry riverbed with a mere trickle, which would become a great torrent in July. Although it seemed monotonous, it never became so as I pulled steadily over the hills to Ono, 15 miles away. This was a routine of my life for about 7 months of the year. I looked forward to the long trips every vacation, and there were plenty of them, for we never had examinations on our oral English, and in the summer there was a long vacation, nearly 2 months. Then comes a trip to China that I told you about last time. And after that was a trip to Korea in the summer of 1922, along without my friend Bill. I have no notes of that memorable trip, but we went first to Wonsan in northern Korea, where the missionaries had their summer cottages by the sea. Paul Reed and I went to stay with one of the missionaries in Korea, at least until our hiking expedition to the Diamond Mountains could be arranged. We loafed by the waters of that quiet harbor, which later became an important center of activity during the war. It must have been the 1st of August, 1922, that we assembled for the long walk. Our chaperone was Miss Carrie Jackson, a middle-aged lady, in contrast to the youthfulness of the rest of us. Besides the young people, along with me, the rest of the crew was a Korean cook and four porters who went ahead, each with a huge pack on his back. At night, we would put up at a monastery designated ahead of time, for there were many of them in the hills, and our chaperones knew them all. 10 days to 2 weeks, we walked through the hills of Congo-san in the midst of splendor and beauty. There were many places where we had to wade or be carried across, many places to take a swim or go across streams with a foot log. We made about 16 miles a day, stayed at monasteries agreed on. Everywhere there were monasteries and trees, and the trees were the result of the monasteries because the rest of Korea was defoliated by the Koreans who cut down the trees for their to heat their houses. But they had lots of other places. The monasteries and trees and great rocks, for here were the trees that were missing from the rest of Korea, and the huge granite cliffs and the quiet canyon vistas with the little minnows played around the rocks. I lost count of the time there in the mountains, except for a few things that counted. Three Buddhas carved on a rock, a long reach of water where 9 dragon falls came down into a beautiful rocky pool, or a monastery chained to the rocks high up on the cliffs. So we came at last to the sea, where the great rocks merge into the sea Congo, where we met the king of tramps, Harry Frank, who was taking notes for the next travel book, Wanderings in Northern China. We too found a boat that could take us back to Wonsan, where we arrived weary but greatly refreshed by what we had seen. From there, Paul and I took a steamer back to Japan by way of Tsuruga. That Christmas, Bill and I took another trip to Korea that was memorable. My first experience with cold weather that nearly froze my ears off. It went down to 10 below zero in Seoul on New Year's Day for a boy from Georgia. That was something. We hugged the fire, and when we went out to mail a letter, the wind was blowing so that we could hardly stand it. We got ready the next day to shake off Chun Chun, that's also in Northern Korea, by the way, in a Model T Ford, with the old-fashioned plastic side curtains to keep us warm. We wrapped up in everything we could find and took along a couple of Korean pigs for warmth. Pig is a hot water bottle, really, that they use for warmth. The equivalent of our hot water bottle. We piled in with two of the girls in the front seat and Bill and two others in the back seat with great robes of fur over us. I shall never forget it, the wild and high passes over the rugged mountains in the full moonlight, the ice-covered stream in the paddy fields along the way, the Han River frozen over with moonbeams glinting on it, the wild uncertainty of the ford, and the getting out to fix a flat tire to scrape off the spark plugs, and on top of it all, the beauty and recklessness of everything as we swung over the mountains. The girls were good sports through it all, and about midnight we arrived at Chun Chun, crossed the river on the ice, had a warm dinner waiting. The house party, that was about what it amounted to, lasted for nearly 2 days with dancing and eating and jokes before an open fire. In case you wonder why missionaries were allowed to dance, we did. We left about 11:30 the next day for Seoul. A bumpy ride, but not nearly as exciting as the ride down. The only other thing I remember about that trip was that the huge boar that was lying on the back of the place where we got a place to stay. He was, the lions and boars and tigers were much in evidence in those days. And this one was hanging there, reminiscent of the boars that were still to be found in the hills of Korea. Korea in 1922 was a strange land of great contrasts, ruled completely by Japan, an old-fashioned country waiting to be awakened. There was no division into North Korea and South Korea, and the dividing line was where we went freely to Songdo and to Chun Chun. The Diamond Mountains are still reposing peacefully in the north. And I presume her mountains and canyons and monasteries are still sleeping in solitude. The mountain passes were made familiar for a year or two by fighting Americans. And then the wild boars and tigers of the woods were forgotten as a line that never should have been drawn broke up the countryside. I wonder what has happened to the thriving missionary community of Songdo, called Kaijo in Japanese. The hospital, the ginseng shed, and the famed textile institute. Seoul, Keijo, has become more familiar to us, more modern, more like the West as we know it. Korea was a land out of the past, filled with men in stately white clothes, all deeply washed and starched from their stiff headgear down to the soft shoes on their feet. The counter to this picture is a group of Korean women at the stream beating out the clothes on the rocks, make them white and crisp for their gentlemen. To ward off the chill winter, they built their houses over a fire underneath the floor, the equivalent of our invisible heat. To get fuel for this method of heating was to strip the hills of all wood, leaving it to the Japanese to reforest it. And they did, too. Now going back to Japan, I don't know how I waited so long to discover Kyoto, but it was my second year before I did so. It was the most charming of all Japanese cities and the most historic. There I stayed with the local Southern Methodist missionaries who were friends of my Georgia parents. Through them I met the new Amherst Doshisha representative, Stuart Burton Nichols. I met him sometime in the late fall of 1922, and we were often together until we left Japan to go back home in 1923. We were together from December of 1922, the beginning of the trip to Korea that Bill and I took. And that day we went to the temples on the northwest of Kyoto, where we were shown into the interior and private passages and treasure rooms. The screens painted by old masters were done mainly in black and white, suggestive of other temples, mountains, and seas. Following day, we visited temples on the southeast side of Kyoto, including the great Buddha of Kyoto, nearly 60 feet high with a great jewel in his head, and his hair and other ornaments painted a bright blue. One of the four largest bells in Japan stood nearby, 14 feet high and 9 inches thick. For 5 sen, about 2 cents, we were allowed to hit the bell with all our strength, with 3 thundering, reverberating, gratifying rings. Sanju Sangendo is the hall that is supposed to contain 33,000 so images of Kwannon, God of Mercy. At the entrance is a 1,000-handed Kwannon where gold lotus leaves and rich ornaments make up the site. From this, the rest of the sub-deities rose in tiers at the top back of the hall, each identical as far as we could tell. And there we went to Chionin Temple, located high above the city, surrounded by hills and forests. The ornate altar arrangement in the midst of huge gilded pillars stretching back and into dim distances suggested to Stuart that this was the acme of typical Oriental architecture and the embodiment of all that is strange, mystic, and fascinating in the East. Stuart could see in this temple in April when thousands of worshippers from all over Japan crowd the city. This time, a procession of 100 priests dressed in heavy silk and brocade robes of every color, cream white, scarlet, gold, maroon, deep blue, purple, and light green. When the elaborate service began inside, brilliant costumes almost lighted up the dark recesses of the interior. Stuart came down to Himeji on February the 10th, and we walked back from the station discussing plans for spring vacation. That afternoon, we walked with Reed up to Masubi-san, a tumble-down Buddhist temple far up in the hills, from which we could get a comfortable view of the sea. We passed 2 Shinto shrines consisting of simple wooden cabinets with cheap vases and withered flowers, a contribution box with a single sen, I think a half penny that is, rattling in it. Stuart's impression of Himeji gave new life to scenes that were old to us. Mountains surround the city, on three sides, rivers wind down below. And this, and the ancient Himeji Castle, built about 1500, stands high on a central hill. The castle is five stories of pure white, marvelously laid out, countless lines of defense, rising like a beacon from the city, can be seen from miles around. We climbed this tower where we could look in four directions, especially at the inland sea with its many colored islands in the afternoon sun. Two weeks later, I was in Kyoto when I saw the Advertiser, which was the main English paper for Japan at that time, printed in Tokyo, came out with my poor poem about the castle, spread in marvelous type square across the editorial page. After I got back to Himeji after a beautiful spring vacation, I received a check of 40 yen from the Advertiser for the poem, my first pay from my pen. I was set up and immediately sent them more and more publications. Several until the Osaka Mainichi started its English edition. Then I shifted my allegiance to Osaka with articles on Mega and Fuji, which I may get to today. Then on the weekend before spring vacation, we went on one of our musicals to Kuri, and that I won't talk about today. A little trip around Awaji, which is the ancient center of Japan. It's a little island off Kobe in the inland sea, and it's a beautiful place. We started on a bicycle tour there, Bill Nunn and I. We got to Hiwaya first. There we rode down the beautiful coast to Sumoto, where we had a wonderful gyunabe. Gyunabe, by the way, is the same as sukiyaki, except it's made with beef instead of chicken. It's usually what we have is sukiyaki. In the late afternoon, we rode across the island to the principal river, to the principal site, Naruto Whirlpool and the Kii Sudo. The next day, we had a memorable trip to see the whirlpool where the waters rush at a terrific rate through the narrow straits between Awaji and Shikoku. It is a grand, inspiring, and fearful sight. A little before noon, we were off to Iwaya, by riding more than an hour in the dark. But we were still too late for the ferry. This is a trip up into Miyanoshita and Hakone and various places around there, done with two of the girls we met in Korea. This may seem strange to you, but two boys from Japan going on a trip with two girls, but it was very platonic and very good. It was too cloudy to see Fuji, but the lovely ride up into the mountains was entrancing. We stayed at the Japanese Inn down near the river, which was lovely and beautiful. It was the first time the girls had stayed in a Japanese Inn. We didn't realize what a shock it was to them. So next day we went to the Fujiya Hotel, which turned out to be not too expensive. Meanwhile, we were off to see Hakone and the great hell, Ojigoku. The walls, the valley, were many seas, many smokes, the steam shooting out the ground. The rumbling and hissing and roaring all made it a fearful place. 6 months later, the great earthquake hit right where we were at this time. We wondered if the big hell might have started it all. Fuji was almost hidden behind the clouds. We caught a fleeting glimpse of its charming whiteness now and then. We went from there up to Ditko, and on the last day at Ditko, we walked down the long avenue of Cryptomeria, the grand old trees mingling their dark green with the gorgeous red and gold, the barbaric gates and temples, the lovely harmony. Back in Meiji, on April 1st, I found myself going back to my French teacher, a nice old Roman Catholic missionary who rattled away for 2 or 3 hours at a time. I got in a word or two. We worked out a method by this time of putting down everything down on typewriter in idiomatic French. He would correct my mistakes and off we would go. Monsieur Charon lived by himself in a small house in Meiji. I don't know where he came from in France, for he never talked of home. By April 19th, I was riding to Tatsuno, my new place, my new assignment. You could almost see the young wheat stretching itself to grow, so pretty and green it was in the fields. By then, the leaves had come out, and the grass was getting green as the earth put on her spring coat. I used to ride over to Tatsuno on Tuesdays on my bicycle and stay overnight. I remember catching fireflies one night when I was there. Many times I would have a little dinner heated on my hibachi. Even though I was there only a few months, the teachers gave me the nicest present when I left. A set of Surimono, which depicted the ladies of Japan in every color and attitude imaginable. At Kobe, Bill and I went, this is the, we take our way from Japan, went to the business office to finish up our business, got our last check for about 1,100 yen, bought traveler's checks for the trip back, who $400 in American Express and $600 in National City. We bought our steamship ticket, third class, in the SS Portos from Yokohama to Portside, in which we received a clergy discount. After buying the ticket, we finished packing, dressed, and went to the ice bowls for farewell dinner. I suppose I can have time for at least one of these trips that I wrote up in the Osaka Mainichi. You can find this, if you could find it, you could find it printed in the Osaka Mainichi for about 1923, but you won't find it because it's outside the Harvard Library because there aren't any copies of it anywhere. This is a we left Kyoto on the express train, got off in Numazu to take a local to Kotemba where we would prepare our climb to Fuji. At Subashiri, we got a room at the Yoniyama Hotel and turned in for a little sleep before climbing. Woke up to find it raining, so turned over to go back to sleep. We stayed that night and nearly all the next day, waiting for the rain to stop and the mist to rise. Occasionally the storm would let up and a rift of blue sky would appear, only to be swallowed up a few moments later by a downpour of beating rain. So we sat in the hotel room and talked about the origin of the universe, about the hotel maids who looked and wondered where we were staying. But as the afternoon got later, clouds lifted from Fuji's snow fields and the great form of the mountain, starting in the air, looked down upon us with a sort of peaceful expression that belied the furies that once burst from the once quiet crater. We dressed quickly, were swell soon on our way up the mountain. We might have taken horses for the first part of our journey, and never missed a thing. The horses reached the limit of their way at the Umbangaeshi, or horse turning back place. We walked all the way. Had we climbed a thousand twinkling lights in the valleys of darkness, told of life in the peasant homes. Far away to the east, there was a glow of reflections of a great light, probably the combined lights of Tokyo. Not far from the top, we took shelter in the hut, fell asleep immediately. It was dark in the little hut, but I had a funny feeling a few hours later that the world was ablaze outside. So I got up and looked through a crack to see the whole world on fire. We were on top of things as we looked out toward the sea, where the great red sun was coming up. All was weak beside the splendor of the sky, a mixture of silver and red, touched with greens and blues and golds. Stuart described it thus to his mother. She wrote a book about him afterwards and put in a lot of the things I might have missed. Then before our very eyes, dazzled by the brilliance of the scene, the sun pushed his golden head above the skylines, sending his rays over and beneath his bad masses of white cloud far below. And now the sky became a swift kaleidoscope of changing shapes and hues, blue and gold dominating, and from the horizon to high above our heads, the clouds rose in variegated profusion of color, while around us below, lovely lakes were set like jewels in the earth's crust. We gazed and we photographed, and then with fresh vigor pushed up the long serrated path to Station 6. Here we had chocolate, tea, and cakes, then on. At every hut we found more climbers. The stations, 9 official ones in all, were closer together, nearer the top. End of his description. We reached the summit, 12,000 feet, about 9. At the top, a fierce wind was blowing, making it necessary to pull the raincoat over the wool shirt and heavy sweater we brought along for warmth. The crater of the extinct volcano was over 500 feet deep, 2,000 feet across the top, with jagged and interesting gorges. After lunch, we started down at terrific speed, going down the slopes where we had laboriously walked around on the way up. We were down in 4 hours and looked back at the glorious and beloved Fuji far above us. That was July 14th, the climax of a beautiful 2 years in Japan. We said goodbye to Stuart, expecting to see him back in the States, but a quick attack of consumption took him away. Beforehand. I think that's far enough to read today. I was going to read you the, if I got to it, the about Mega and the Yatai, but I suppose that'll have to wait for another time. I could give you a sample of it. I wrote about several significant happenings down during my stay in Japan. One was about a Shinto fishing festival near Himeji called When Mega Emerges. It was published in the English edition of the Osaka Mainichi on June 30th, 1923, just before I left. This is the way I wrote it up. Mega is like many another Japanese fishing village along the coast of the Inland Sea, except for 2 days in the year. On these 2 days, in mid-October, it emerges from the hard shell small boats and torn nets and thatched huts that means life and sustenance. Like a moth, it flies out into the night, into the bright and beautiful sunshine, trying its new wings in the freedom of the heavens. Mega is then the beautiful and varicolored moth, darting here and there in a frenzy of excitement over the new joys and undreamed of happiness. Soon the fluttering gaiters are ended. The moth is dead. Surely another will fly with the next redding of the maples, and Mega goes back to its boats and its nets. I described the festival for 2 days there, and then let it go. I think we'll stop there.
Thank you so much. Any questions or comments from Pete to Ed?
Who was driving the Model T? Model T?
Hirsch from Song Go. He was really driving.
Dick?
Pete, in so many ways, a rope band, but one of your unique features must be, he must be the only rope.
Yes, I think that's true.
I was interested in hearing you say that the Koreans chopped down all the trees every year. I thought that was a post-World War II event.
Oh, no. No, that was done long before the Korean occupation by Japan. And when I was over there, it was pretty well grown up in pine trees that had been set out on the hills.
Of course, you
get in places like the Diamond Mountains where there were trees for one reason or another. And I think that's what kept them together.
Les?
Did you say you crossed over some frozen river? On the road, a Georgian gentleman like you survived the cold.
I don't know.
That was something, Bob.
Those are black diamonds. The mines in North Korea, are those for black diamonds or the regular diamonds?
I didn't get you.
What kind of diamond mines were
there? They're not diamond mines. They're called diamond mountains.
Oh, I know.
Because that was a way with the...
As I understand, Korea does have black diamonds.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Pete, I know baseball has always, in recent years, been popular in Japan, but they were playing baseball in 1921 then.
Oh, yes.
I didn't realize that...
All the kids, these kids were playing baseball. They had a soft ball, very much like our soft tennis ball, that they used for that.
But probably not professional baseball like they have today.
No.
Pete, are there pilgrims going up Mount Fuji all the time?
Are there what?
Pilgrims and processions.
Oh, my, yes. Oh, thousands and thousands of them.
Do they interfere with your progress?
Oh, no. Especially not at early morning when I got up at 6 o'clock. That was a great time.
I wanted to ask you about the castles. You mentioned waking in the morning with those castles spread over here. During what years did they build these castles in Japan?
Well, some were built in my history may be a little hazy there, but I think they were built during the time of Hideyoshi. Isn't that right?
1500.
Yeah, 1500, 1600.
Sure, it's about the same time that the Spanish were building theirs.
I suppose. Yes. They built them then, and there are other castles. Canada is the major. Maybe is the main large one that is still surviving. There's a Nagoya, which we visited later on, had a much larger castle, but it burned down. And then it was rebuilt, so that it is now the largest castle in Japan.
They collected from the Japanese school children for the gold on top of that phoenix.
The what?
Remember that? That phoenix, the gold phoenix on top of that castle, was rebuilt by the Japanese school children.
Well, Pete, we certainly thank you very much. I'm sure many of us have visited Japan, and some of us will visit Japan, but I don't think any of us will ever visit Japan 55 years ago, and we enjoyed the trip. Thank you.
Thank you.